Welcome to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. First up, First Nations hockey player seeks long playoff run and post-secondary offer by Sam Lascaris from Windspeaker. Besides looking to finish his junior hockey career on a high note, Caleb LaBelle is also spending time thinking about his academic and athletic futures. LaBelle of the Bitigong Ninashbe, a First Nation in Northern Ontario, is a defenseman with the Cam River Fighting Walleye. A junior A club based in Thunder Bay, Ontario, is one of seven entrants in the Superior International Junior Hockey League. This circuit features six franchises from Northern Ontario and the Michigan-based Ironwood Lumberjacks. The Fighting Walleye are the defending International Junior Hockey League, SIJHL, champions, and they participated this past May at the Centennial Club, the National Junior A tournament. The Cam River squad managed to win one of its four round-robin matches at the Canadian tourney held in Calgary. "We're looking pretty strong again this year," said LaBelle, who turned 21 on January 5th. "I'm sure trying to push for another championship, trying to go back-to-back, and try to go to the Centennial Cup again with the group we have this year." The 2026 Centennial Cup will be staged in Summerside, PEI, beginning May 7th. Within the coming months, LaBelle will have to decide where to further his hockey career. He's hoping to become a lawyer focusing on Indigenous law, or a teacher, preferably at an Indigenous school. This year's Cam River Club is a veteran-laden one. SIJHL squads are allowed up to eight over-agers, players who are 20 when the 25-26 season started. "We're maxed out on 20-year-olds, and we have quite a bit of 19-year-olds," LaBelle said, "so we're an older group for sure. We have a lot of experience mixed in with some younger guys that are pretty eager to get going and be successful." LaBelle, a defensive-minded blue liner, has earned 11 points, including 3 goals, in his first 32 regular season games this season. With his size, skills, and experience, LaBelle is hoping to play at the U Sports level, the Canadian University Circuit. He would love to suit up for the Thunder Bay-based Lakehead University Thunder Wolves, who compete in U Sports' Ontario Conference, the Ontario University Athletics, OUA. LaBelle's brother, Trevor, played at Lakehead from 2010 through 2014. "That would be awesome to stay in my hometown," LaBelle said. "That would be great if they would offer me a spot on the team. Honestly, at this point, I'd like to go anywhere in the OUA where they have a good program, good schooling, and a good hockey team. But it would be a dream come true to go play for Lakehead." The Thunder Wolves are one of the top OUA teams this season. "It's always been like a dream of mine to play U Sports," LaBelle added. "It's a great league, especially the OUA. It's very strong and a lot of good things have happened in that league. Players have advanced to professional hockey or even outside hockey. They have advanced to great jobs in the future in the work field." LaBelle's brother, now a teacher in Thunder Bay, has stayed involved with the sport by coaching his two daughters. Some American-based schools have expressed interest in LaBelle's services for next season. "There haven't been any offers," LaBelle said, "but I've been talking to a few schools, so we'll see what happens. I'm just kind of weighing all my options." Cam River's general manager, Kevin McCollum, is confident LaBelle will be playing at the post-secondary level next season. "I know typically interest starts to heat up in our league towards February and early March," McCollum said of the university squads. "He will play college hockey. It's just a matter of where at this point." This is LaBelle's third season with the Fighting Walleye. He also spent a portion of the 24-25 campaign with the Pickering Panthers in the Ontario Junior Hockey League, OJHL. LaBelle started his junior career with the OJHL's Lindsay Muskies 4 years ago. He only played 3 matches with the Muskies before being dealt to the Hearst Lumberjacks, who participate in the Northern Ontario Junior Hockey League. "He's grown so much as a player and as a person over these last couple of years," McCollum said. "It's been an absolute pleasure to watch, and he is a great kid. He does so much for the community. Besides playing for the Fighting Walleye, LaBelle is working part-time at Ke Nachihi, a Thunder Bay healing lodge. It's great, he said, of his maintenance work there. It's good experience. It's awesome. You get to learn a lot, and it's nice to be intertwined with another indigenous organization that wants to give back to their communities and give back to indigenous cultures. LaBelle completed his high school studies in 2023. While he was primarily focused on his hockey career since then, he's eager to go to university and become a student athlete again. I think it will just be an adjustment, but I'm ready for it, he said. I think the big thing about it is just being mature enough and ready to make a decision on what you want to take and what you want to do moving forward. I think it will be a good routine to get into, being a student athlete and being able to manage playing hockey at a high level and also keeping your academics up. I'm pretty excited and looking forward to that. Up next, RFK Jr.'s MAHA movement has picked up steam in state houses. Here's what to expect in 2026 by Alan Greenblatt from KFF Health News. When one of Adam Berkhammer's foster children struggled with hyperactivity, the West Virginia legislator and his wife decided to alter their diet and remove any foods that contained synthetic dyes. We saw a turnaround in his behavior and our other children, said Berkhammer, who has adopted or fostered 10 kids with his wife. These are real impacts on real kids. The Republican turned his experience into legislation, sponsoring a bill to ban 7 dyes from food sold in the state. It became law in March, making West Virginia the first state to institute such a ban from all food products. The bill was among a slew of state efforts to regulate synthetic dyes. In 2025, roughly 75 bills aimed at food dyes were introduced in 37 states, according to the National Conference of State Legislators. Chemical dyes and nutrition are just part of the broader Make America Healthy Again agenda. Promoted by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., MAHA ideas have made their deepest inroads at the state level, with strong support from Republicans, and in some places, from Democrats. The $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program, created last year as part of the GOP's One Big Beautiful Bill Act to expand healthcare access in rural areas, offers incentives to states that implement MAHA policies. Federal and state officials are seeking a broad swath of health policy changes, including rolling back routine vaccinations and expanding the use of drugs such as ivermectin for treatments beyond their approved use. State lawmakers have introduced dozens of bills targeting vaccines, fluoridated water, and PFAS, a group of compounds known as forever chemicals that have been linked to cancer and other health problems. In addition to West Virginia, 6 other states have targeted food dyes with new laws or executive orders, requiring warning labels on certain foods with certain dyes or banning the sale of such products in schools. California has had a law regulating food dyes since 2023. Most synthetic dyes used to color food have been around for decades. Some clinical studies have found a link between their use and hyperactivity in children. And in early 2025, in the last days of President Joe Biden's term, the Food and Drug Administration outlawed the use of dye known as Red No. 3. Major food companies including Nestle, Hershey, and PepsiCo have gotten on board, pledging to eliminate at least some color additives from food products over the next year or two. We anticipate that the momentum we saw in 2025 will continue into 2026, with a particular focus on ingredient safety and transparency, said John Hewitt, the Senior Vice President of State Affairs for the Consumer Brands Association, a trade group for food manufacturing. This past summer, the group called on its members to voluntarily eliminate federally certified artificial dyes from their products by the end of 2027. The state laws are really what's motivating companies to get rid of dyes, said Jensen Jose, Regulatory Counsel for the Center of Science in the Public Interest, a nonprofit health advocacy group. Andy Baker-White, the Senior Director of State Health Policy for the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, said the bipartisan support bill targeting food dyes and ultra-processed food struck him as unusual. Several red states have proposed legislation modeled on California's 2023 law, which bans 4 food additives. It's not very often you see states like California and West Virginia at the forefront of an issue together, Baker-White said. Although Democrats have joined Republicans in some of these efforts, Kennedy continues to drive the agenda. He appeared with Texas officials when the state enacted a package of food-related laws, including one that bars individuals who participate in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, from using their benefits to buy candy or sugary drinks. In December, the U.S. Department of Agriculture approved similar waivers sought by 6 states. 18 states will block SNAP purchases of those items in 2026. There are bound to be more. The Rural Health Transformation Program also offers incentives to states that implemented restrictions on SNAP. There are real and concrete effects where the rural health money gives points for changes in SNAP eligibility or the SNAP definitions, Baker-White said. In October, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill that sets a legal definition for ultra-processed foods and will phase them out of schools. It's a move that may be copied in other states in 2026, while also providing fodder for legal battles. In December, San Francisco City Attorney David Chu sued major food companies, accusing them of selling harmful and addictive products. The lawsuit names specific brands, including cereals, pizzas, sodas, and potato chips, linking them to serious health problems. Kennedy has also blamed ultra-processed foods for chronic diseases, but even proponents of the efforts to tackle nutrition concerns don't agree on which foods to target. MAHA adherents on the right haven't focused on sugar and sodium as much as policymakers on the left. The parties have also butted heads over some Republicans' champion of raw milk, which can spread harmful germs, and the consumption of saturated fat, which contributes to heart disease. Policymakers expect other flashpoints. Moves by the FDA and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that are making vaccine access more difficult have led blue states to find ways to set their own standards apart from federal recommendations, with 15 Democratic governors announcing a new public health alliance in October. Meanwhile, more red states may eliminate vaccine mandates for employees. Idaho made them illegal. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing to eliminate school vaccine mandates. Even as Kennedy advocates eliminating artificial dyes, the Environmental Protection Agency has loosened restrictions on chemicals and pesticides, leading MAHA activists to circulate an online petition calling on President Donald Trump to fire EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin. Congress has yet to act on most MAHA proposals, but state lawmakers are poised to tackle many of them. If we're honest, the American people have lost faith in some of our federal institutions, whether FDA or CDC, said Berkhammer, the West Virginia lawmaker. We're going to step up as states and do the right thing. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, Rappahannock Tribe Challenges 9 Million Gallon Water Plan by Native News Online staff. The Rappahannock Tribe has filed an appeal challenging a state-issued permit that allows Caroline County to withdraw up to 9 million gallons of water per day from the Rappahannock River and transfer it to the Mattapony River. The appeal follows the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality's approval in November 2025 of the permit and seeks to protect both rivers, uphold tribal sovereignty and treaty rights, and challenge what the tribe calls failures in the state's water permitting process. We raised concerns throughout the permitting process regarding inadequate consultation, impacts on cultural resources, and violation of treaty rights, in violation of the tribe's constitutional rights of nature provisions, said Chief Ann Richardson. Despite these concerns, the permit was approved without meaningful tribal consultation. The tribe said it formally requested that the state conduct visual and auditory impact modeling before final site selection and asked for consultations on ways to reduce harm to the rivers. Those requests were not granted, the tribe said. The tribe is also concerned about the impact of the water withdrawal on anadromous fish species, including Atlantic sturgeon, which are known to exist near the proposed intake area. That stretch of Rappahannock River as critical habitat for Atlantic sturgeon under the Endangered Species Act, and both state and federal law prohibit harm to the species. Despite those concerns, DEQ issued the permit without waiting for completion of a Virginia Institute of Marine Science study on the cumulative impacts of surface water withdrawals, the tribe said. The tribe also objects to the interbasin transfer of treated water to the Mattaponi River, saying science-based analysis were not conducted to assess potential impacts on water quality, salinity, and temperature that could harm ecosystems. David Reed, executive director of the Chesapeake Legal Alliance and counsel for the tribe, criticized the scope of the project. Approving a project that allows 9 times the demonstrated water needs for the county and relying on speculative need and studies that have yet to be completed or even started is not in the best interest of the public, the river, or the tribe, Reed said. The tribe is also seeking clarity on the condition of the water after it is used and how its return to the Mattaponi River could affect aquatic life. The tribe said the water's quality is likely to be degraded and that changes in salinity could harm fish and ecosystems. Without comprehensive impact studies, the tribe argues the environmental consequences cannot be responsibly addressed. In addition, the tribe said the state and county failed to seriously consider alternative water supply options, including purchasing finished water from neighboring jurisdictions, expanding conservation measures, or maintaining partial reliance on groundwater. To the tribe's knowledge, neither Caroline County nor DEQ has explained why those alternatives were not pursued. As a federally recognized sovereign nation, the tribe said it has a right to meaningful consultation when decisions could affect ancestral waters and constitutional protections for the Rappahannock River. The tribe specifically requested consultation during this process, and the agency chose not to engage them in any meaningful way, instead failing to even notify the tribe when the permit was approved, Reed said. The tribe is also demanding transparency about the assumptions used to justify the scale of the withdrawal. Earlier project documents referenced industrial cooling needs, including possible data center development. While the permit is now based on projected residential growth, the tribe said it has asked for clarification about the data supporting those projections and the justification for increasing the county's usage level from 1 million to 9 million gallons per day. The tribe said it will continue to pursue legal remedies to protect Rappahannock and Mattaponi rivers and to press for water management decisions that respect environmental protection, tribal sovereignty, and long-term sustainability. In our next story, Sandy Whitehawk remembers Alex Preddy, the VA nurse who understood her, by Levi Rickert. Sandy Whitehawk, Rosebud Sue, is an award-winning, longtime advocate for Native American children and the elder in residence at the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, NABS, where she previously served as president of its board. Recently, Whitehawk faced her own personal battle with a health issue that landed her in the intensive care unit at the Minneapolis Veterans Administration Hospital. While there, she was treated by Alex Preddy, a VA ICU nurse whose death recently at the hands of the U.S. Border Patrol officers sparked national outrage and widespread protest. Through our extensive coverage of Indian boarding schools, our Native News Online staff, including me, have interacted with Sandy numerous times. I interviewed her, and the interview has been edited for clarity and brevity. Native News Online. I understand you were just released from the VA hospital in Minneapolis on Monday. While there, you were a patient of Alex Preti, who was tragically killed recently. Tell us about your interactions with him while he was your attending nurse. Sandy Whitehawk. I want to say first and foremost that the ICU team that works there, the nurses, are remarkable. Alex was assigned to me. The thing that struck me about him was he was one of those individuals who would just go above and beyond, making sure you're comfortable and making suggestions about things that would help. He was always, always smiling, and he made it seem like when I needed something, and it felt like I needed a lot, I was okay asking. I said, I think I became high maintenance. And I remember him laughing about that. He said, you're not high maintenance. You just need help right now. He was always encouraging and nurturing and liked to visit. He wanted to hear about my service. And we ended up talking about my time in the Oneida National Color Guard. I got to tell him some awesome stories from that experience. And I could tell he was genuinely interested. He even said, I really like listening to the old guys talk about their experience. He was someone who really put his patients at ease. His genuine interest in your service, your life, and who you are all contributes to healing because you can relax and feel safe. That's what I experienced with him. He was always smiling. No matter what was going on, he had a smile on his face. Native News Online. In a Facebook post, you wrote that he truly understood you. What do you mean by that? Sandy Whitehawk. I felt like he understood the vulnerability someone feels when they're that sick and have to depend on others for help. No one likes to be vulnerable. He had a way of conveying that it didn't matter that you had just turned your light on 20 minutes ago. He understood that hesitancy. It's hard to put into words, but he always knew how to put you at ease. I didn't have to explain my background or why it's hard for me to ask for help. That in itself was healing. That's the energy he carried every time we interacted. Native News Online. If there was one word you could use to describe Alex Preti, what would it be? Sandy Whitehawk. Nurturing. Very nurturing. Native News Online. How did you find out that he was killed by Border Patrol officers? Sandy Whitehawk. I didn't know at first because I wasn't watching much TV. I was on Facebook, but not really paying attention. Then I got a text from a friend who asked, Sandy, would you happen to know this nurse from your time at the VA? She wasn't even thinking about the ICU. I think she thought maybe I knew him from before. I said, geez, he looks a lot like Alex. And I told her I'd try to confirm it. Then I started thinking, could it be Alex? It was unbelievable. So I asked one of the nurses. I said, was the man who was shot Alex Preti? And she said yes. He had just taken care of me a week before. Just a week before. The nurses who knew him and had worked with him were devastated. Everyone was shocked and could barely talk without tears coming to their eyes. I just couldn't believe it. I kept saying, really? What? When I finally saw the video and what happened, I thought, yes, that's who he was. He was nurturing and took care of people. Of course he would have tried to help the woman who was pushed down. Of course he would have put himself in between to protect her. That's who he was, a protector. It was so hard to accept that it was him, of all people. Not that anyone deserves that, but this man, this nurse, was nurturing and extremely knowledgeable. He was always expanding his knowledge. I think he was involved in medical research. We didn't have words. We were all in tears when we found out. And the way they tried to villainize him made it even harder because it was the complete opposite of who he really was, who we knew and experienced. Native News Online. As we bring this interview to a close, what is your last word? Sandy Whitehawk. I really appreciate you inviting us to speak so we can share what we know. People get so much misinformation. In our white community, people often feel pretty safe because they haven't experienced the same onslaught that we have. But now that they saw Renee and they saw Alex, they're realizing, hey, this can really happen to anyone. It wakes that spirit up in them. That spirit was always there, but they didn't have the opportunity to see it, to recognize that it was there in them, that they are community. Our next story is family supporters mourn Emily Pike 1 year after her disappearance. Many gather at an Arizona memorial to pray for the young San Carlos Apache girl. By Darren Thompson for ICT, Indian Country News. Mesa, Arizona. More than 100 people gathered at an intersection on Sunday evening to acknowledge 14-year-old Emily Pike's disappearance 1 year ago. It was the last place she was seen. What we have here means something, not just to us, but to her family, her siblings, said Jared Marquez, a missing and murdered Indigenous people advocate at the vigil. Not only do we honor the love we have as a community for this girl, to the family and her siblings, but we seek justice. May we pray here today and hope that fear leaves the body of the person who knows something and lets them come forward, Marquez said. Pike went missing on January 27, 2025. Her body was found by hikers on February 14, 2025, off Highway 60, near her home community of the San Carlos Apache in Globe, Arizona, more than 100 miles away from Mesa. Her death has been investigated as a homicide, but her death remains unsolved. Federal investigators are offering a $200,000 reward for an arrest related to Pike's death. Pike's siblings and family attended the candlelight vigil at the intersection of Mesa Drive and McKellips Road, where she was last seen and not far from the group home she ran away from. Her disappearance sheds light on the already strained state-funded and managed behavioral health system that has defrauded the state more than $2.8 billion while targeting members of federally recognized tribes from beyond the state of Arizona. Earlier this month, Pike's memorial items were removed from the northwest intersection and placed in the trash. But her supporters quickly replaced the site with flowers, signs, balloons, and candles honoring her memory. Several reports indicate that the city of Mesa did not remove her memorial and that a private owner of the vacant lot removed them without knowing. There are formal efforts to memorialize Pike, though. A memorial will be added to the Fitch Park in Mesa this year and will include a bench and a tree planted in Emily Pike's honor. An Arizona Department of Transportation highway memorial sign will be erected at milepost 277 north of Gila County Highway 60, near where her body was found. Several groups of people, including men, women, and youth, sang traditional songs to honor Pike. Her story has inspired many, and people from various walks of life joined to honor her life. She was in the midst of her childhood, and you know, still trying to understand what it means to be here, what her purpose is, said Gabriel Garcia, Tohono O'odham Nation, who sang a traditional O'odham song. She didn't get the same family treatment that other kids get, and this is something that all children should be able to experience, the goodness of understanding who they are, where they come from, embracing who they are, and where they want. After Emily's death, the state legislature passed a statewide alert system called the Turquoise Alert and is also known as Emily's Law. The alert system is similar to other alert systems and is issued for at-risk individuals from Indigenous communities whose circumstances do not fit amber or silver alert criteria. Justine Robinson, White Mountain Apache Tribe, is raising Pike's other siblings and told ICT, "Everyone has to keep an eye on their kids. That's the main thing. Awareness that our children can go missing is one thing, and unity and coming together as a community is another." You've been listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.